This is an interview with Rebecca Lurie, February 28, 1995, at the Labor Technical College. Rebecca, let's see. Can you tell me about your work history?
Okay. All of it, huh? Or the non-traditional part of it?
Yeah, you know, how you evolved into the non-traditional part of it.
Okay. Actually, when I was in college, I worked weekends taking care of retarded adults and disadvantaged youth. That was different house parents in different programs, upstate New York. And I was kind of involved in some sort of like alternative energy thing, so I got involved in a house building project. Mm. But I knew nothing about construction, but I got involved through the alternative energy aspect. And when I graduated college with a BA in sociology, I thought that I might get a job doing more of what I had been doing.
Yeah.
And the irony of it was I didn't have any clothes for an interview. I remember thinking, like, I could do this, but I don't have the wardrobe for this. Where do I start? So there was this big hurdle. I didn't have clothes for interviews. And I'll go to Salvation Army. I tried to find something, because I was like this little country dyke who just, like, you know, I wore jeans. I was a hippie. I didn't have clothes for a straight job.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
A friend, an acquaintance, got a contract for a job that some friends of mine were with this company. It was sort of a hippie-run, it was a food, it was kind of like a supplier to food co-ops in the Northeast, to food warehouse for food co-ops in the Northeast. They were a warehouse and trucking company, owner-run and operated, collectively-run. And they were renovating their warehouse, and they put in the contract, they required in the contract that a woman or a minority get trained in the renovation. So it was kind of a progressive company that was doing the job. So an acquaintance said, well, I know this, they referred me, so someone asked me if I wanted the job, and I said, yeah, I'll try that. I mean, I was kind of like, they knew me through the alternative energy stuff. So I went to work, and I got my first hammer the first week. I really didn't know much, and it was a warehouse. It was like almost like working outside because it was all such a rough space, and it was dead winter, and that I was all comfortable with, sort of, you know, wearing long underwear and dressing. But the guys I was working with taught me everything. I knew nothing, and we worked together into the spring, and then one of the guys took another small job and asked me to stay with him, and then. With another guy, we kind of talked about starting a company, because he didn't have much of a company, he was just a little independent. So I got involved very early contracting, and I didn't know much about the business, but I knew more about business than they did. So together, you know, I was good on the client relations, and I was able to do estimates, because I was able to talk on the phone, get information. I was reading books about how you do things. And we started this little company that lasted for about another 6 months, and I just kept learning as we went. And sometimes I would work with them, and sometimes I would work on my own on very small projects. And I remember this one project where they sort of left me for the afternoon, and I had to, it was like a really cheap motel. It was like almost like Formica on the walls. It's very cheap. I don't know what they call it. It's very cheap plastic laminate wall covering. And I put the hole in the wrong place for the pipe, and that's the kind of thing you can't patch, right? And there, at the front of one of the books, what's that book that Dale, what's her name, Dale?
Against the Grain?
Against the Grain, right. Someone had got me that book during this time. And Against the Grain, there was a good carpenter knows how to fix her mistakes, an expression. So I was all by myself, and there was this mantra that I just started chanting, a good carpenter knows how to fix her mistakes, and that was for me an experience, because I figured out a way to fix my mistake. And a lot of, you know, trial and error in life. And then as time went on, I would take on little side jobs for myself. I built a bookcase for somebody. I never built bookcases before. And then I heard about this old man who was a contractor who always needed a helper. And he always had women be his helper, was what I found out once I took the job. And I worked with him. I mean, this is upstate New York in late 70s, early 80s, or early 1980, 1981. Where $5 an hour was the going rate for someone who was learning their trade. Off the books, $5 an hour. And I managed on that. because I just was living sort of simply. Mm. And with friends, you know, rent was cheap, and I either rode my bike or hitchhiked or got rides with friends. Eventually, I was able to buy a little car. I mean, I didn't need much, so I was able to manage on very little. And I worked with this old man for another 6 months or so, and he, or more, on and off. He was a real tradesman from the old school, but he was losing it physically and psychologically a little bit. And he really needed someone who just sort of fed his ego, which is why I think he had women work for him, because he could tell us what to do, and we'd do exactly what he said, and we didn't ask too many, we asked a lot of questions to feed his ego, but we didn't question him. You know, we didn't question his abilities. He would take us for 3-hour lunches because he was having a tough day. Or he would have us clean out a garage one day. He was working for a very dear friend of his who was renovating her house, and it was kind of like she was doing him a favor. So here we were, everybody was babysitting each other, but in the interim I learned a lot of good little tricks of the trade. And during that time I called the union in the area and asked them about their apprenticeship and how you get in, and they said they'd call me when the chance came up. And during that time they called me, and I went, left him, went on a union job, started the apprenticeship program. And then when there wasn't work with the union, I went back with him, and when there was work, I left and went back. And I did that for about a year, and then I moved back to New York City, because I was from New York, and I was getting bored in the country. I'd spent 8 years there, and I felt like it was time to get back to the city for bigger reasons, not work-related, but politically. I was more motivated to do other things, and I was, because this is a political activist thing, I was doing a lot of leftist work in the country. I was doing anti-Klan work and solidarity work for South Africa and El Salvador. And after a while, you work with the same 20 people. It was, the community was very small, and I was getting very frustrated. And you do your projects, but there was only so much room for growth, it felt like. And I was relating to New York City a lot on political things, so I moved down here. And when I moved down here, someone told me about non-traditional employment for women, and I contacted them to help me transfer my book. I needed to figure out how to get into the union down here. And they helped me shape, and because the way you have to do it then, in the carpenters, was you had to find a job, and then the local would take you in. So I shaped with people from New for probably about a month before I got in. And I got a job in Washington Heights, and I got into Local 17. Which at the time, I didn't realize that that was not necessarily a good thing, because Local 17 is not, I don't want to quote it on this or anything, other than it's not really, it wasn't one of the best unions to be in, one of the best locals. Not a lot of work. Not a lot of work in there. So, as time went on, I worked through the local, and I also was doing political work, and the most significant political work I was doing at the time was I started getting involved with construction brigades to Nicaragua. And I worked until and organized a brigade, and about a year later, I left my job to go to Nicaragua for 2 months. And what I did was I told my boss that I had to go take care of my sick sister, so he laid me off, so I was able to collect unemployment. I went to Nicaragua. It was actually for just a little over a month. We built a school. And when I came back, the union didn't send me out to work right away, so I did odd jobs, and I worked for little small contractors, non-union, who were just willing to take me on, a woman, a gay man, a couple of friends of friends who put me to work. And I kept working. I also took on some jobs of my own, that things I felt challenged but able to do. And I kept doing that. I kept working one way or another. And then, let's see. Eventually I got hooked up with a contractor who I worked for about 3 years. Non-union, but he helped me pay my union dues during the time, and he sent me on a lot of the union sites that he had to finagle onto. And he hooked me up with some union contractors, so he could still be the sort of GC, but I was working for a sub, and a lot of things. I ended up in some awkward, although fine, situations. Awkward now, because I work for the union. I would, some of the things I don't want to go on record about necessarily with my name, the union, non-union thing.
We'll see the transcript before And they'll always be, you know, everybody will always have to have your permission to see it.
Okay, I don't, I mean, who's it for?
It's for the Tamament Labor Archives at NYU.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine, I think, I mean, it's just, politically, it's awkward to be in the position I'm in, because the fact is that I got some really good breaks non-union, training-wise. I had people who, because they were sort of a progressive, from a progressive world, they let me work with all my tools, they let me learn, they let me, you know, and I got really good training, I got really good experience, I got really good hands-on opportunities that in the union I might have had a hard time getting. Well, the fact is that the union wasn't sending me out on jobs, the local, and I didn't really know how else to get a job, but they put my name on the list, and I never got called. So in the meantime, I've kept on figuring out other ways to work. So that went on and on for a while, and I just spearheaded to other job opportunities. I organized other brigades. I was able to leave the job, go to Nicaragua, come back, get another job through the same network, the informal network I had created. And in the whole time, I kept going to the apprenticeship program, and I completed my school, I completed schooling. I didn't have the hours that you need to complete your apprenticeship, but I had the, officially, I didn't have the union hours, but I had been working steadily in carpentry.
But then, do they still let you be a journey person? Or
yeah, they do. Yeah. You don't get your official grad certificate from the international, but they do. And now I have the hours, because then I eventually went back to the union. One of the jobs I took after a while, which is not considered non-union, I took a job with, I went and applied for a job with the New York Public Library. Because I had worked for a contractor that got a job in one of the libraries, and I met the guys that worked at the library, and I ended up applying. And it was a very interesting job for me, because it was the first, like, a more official job I went into as a journey person, not as an apprentice. They all were official jobs. I got paychecks. Most of them were on the books. It was just that it was a union. It wasn't the Carpenters Union job. It was the City DC 37 job. But I applied as a full mechanic, and I got the job as a full mechanic, and I realized I was a full mechanic. There was nothing less. And I realized that, I mean, actually during that time when I worked for some of these other smaller contractors, I was running the work. I didn't really doubt my ability. I had grown to be, in some cases, I was even a foreperson for some of the smaller companies. But it was just about going out into the bigger world and saying that I am a mechanic. And I went and I did it, and I got this job. And it was a very interesting job, because it was in the main branch of the New York Public Library, and I love New York, and this was in the basement of one of these fantastic buildings, and fixing things was fun, and but the pay was really low. I was getting paid like first or second year apprenticeship wages. So I got frustrated with that, and eventually a friend of mine knew somebody in my local and made a call for me, and the local sent me out on the job. So I did end up getting back into the union after like pushing it and pushing it. Going out as a mechanic. And then I went out as a mechanic for years, for another, like, oh, that was like 86, 87, you know, until about 2 years ago when I stopped working in the field to have the baby.
Like what kinds of jobs? All different kinds of jobs, or did they?
The first job I got was with a woodworking company, and it was from a series of calls and pushing to get this job and with this company that I got it, and then, so I worked with a woodworking company for a while, and then the next job I got was a general contractor. And that was, so I did ceilings, and I did drywall, and I did the finished work. Mostly those things. I didn't do too much concrete except during my apprenticeship.
Was there ever any other women on your jobs?
Rarely, no. Yeah. No, not much. Sometimes an electrician. Well, during my apprenticeship, I worked at North River, which is one of the big water pollution treatment plants, and there were a lot of women on that job, carpenters and all trades. And there was a lot of federal dollars on that job, so that's probably had to do with that.
So then you came to teach at the carpenter school.
Well, yeah, I During my time in the field, I knew at a certain point I had an interest in teaching, and I contacted the school. And I had to pursue it a little bit, but I ended up getting a position teaching here in the evening, one night a week, starting in 88. And I really liked it. I had really wanted it, I think. I knew I wanted to teach. And I was very nervous, like, am I good enough to teach? I'm not that. It's not that long that I've been out of the program. But I really enjoyed teaching. And then when I got pregnant, I decided that I didn't want to work. I wasn't quite sure how I was going to handle being pregnant in the field. I was very nervous about it. I'm kind of large anyway, so I thought sort of being pregnant, I'd get even bigger, and how am I going to move around, and how agile can I be, and on the ladder, and all of this. So after like about 3 months pregnant, never knew that the pregnancy was going fine, I started putting the word out that I was looking for some other opportunity. And I was told that non-traditional employment for women would be looking for a part-time instructor. So I thought that would be good. Part-time, I wasn't really looking for something part-time. But the idea of a part-time instructor meant that I might be able to do this, not just through the pregnancy, but after I had the baby and stuff. And that's basically what happened. I went to them when I was like 4 months pregnant and worked. Although it was part-time, which was less than I would have liked to work immediately, it worked out very well for the first year of Tyler's life, because I kept on working part-time, and that was really nice, and that worked well. And I taught, and as time went on in that program, there became more and more administrative duties that needed to happen besides the teaching, in addition to the teaching. And I got more involved with program development at New, and I stayed there for 2 years. And then the Carpenters asked me to come on full-time as a counselor. When I did that, I gave up my teaching position at the Carpenter School because it just felt like I'd be spread too thin to be full-time as a counselor and have to put in another night a week and have my family. So I gave up my teaching position, and I'm here full-time, sort of like managing students and giving them advice and going out and doing public speaking about what it's like to be a carpenter and getting involved in some program development.
But where do you do the public speaking?
Public schools.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's great.
The schools ask us on career days to come and speak. And we go to mostly middle schools, junior high schools, and high schools.
And your partner's a carpenter, too.
Yes.
That's great, a house full of carpenters.
Right.
So, how's it been being a tradeswoman mom?
Well, Tyler's favorite room in the house is the shop.
And it's great you have a shop.
Huh?
It's great, yeah.
We have a little basement. We have a basement. Yeah. And I get a little nervous that dust might not be good for him or something. But he loves, how's it been? I mean, our schedules when I was teaching in Ellie's schedule, because she's working in the field, is he come home early enough that he can, I think if he worked a real straight kind of straight office job, he'd get home, at dinner time. At least one of us gets home before dinner time. You have time to cook and pick him up. I think the most significant thing about being a carpenter mom at this point, being a lesbian mom, is that because Ellie, who I parent with, and my partner, and is also a carpenter in the union, and also teaches at the school, we weren't out. Well, we didn't think we were out when we were together without a kid. And I definitely know I wasn't out at my job in the field because I was referred to as an old maid and I left along with a joke. But at the school, we now are out. To anyone who, can sort of see the obvious and can figure out how to state the obvious, I mean, I'm not going to push down anybody's throat. That's not the intent. But we're out because we share a son.
Right.
And it's like, this is our family. And it's acknowledged, more in the context of family, not in the context of sexuality. We are who we are.
Right.
And that's been really interesting, I think, because I think it's kind of easier to come out in the context of this is my family than in the context of this is who I sleep with. And I think people understand that it's a little less threatening when it's based on this child that they will meet and see. And, how's your kid? And you can show pictures and you can all talk about parenting issues. And everyone talks about Disney World and, what did he say and what's a good video and these issues, And then an expression Tyler came into bed with us this morning. And I'm just talking about my life.
Right.
I'm referring to Ellie and I sharing the bed. Right. It's like, it's their problem. I've I've heard me say this, and I've thought about it, and I've said, well, that's just the truth. And
yeah.
It's not so awkward, I think. But it comes up.
Yeah.
With people who are at work who I'm talking with.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those are some of the things, and I think mostly people deal with it or don't. And I don't, they don't say it to my face if they have a hard time dealing with it.
Hmm. So have you found child care to be adequate since you have a partner? And
child care's tough. I just spent
yeah.
time today. I mean, we've had good child care. We had a home. We had, when Tyler was first born, I had somebody who came with me to work.
Hmm.
And I nursed him, and she watched him while I, for the hours that I would be in the classroom. And for a few months, he came to work with me.
Hmm.
And then for the next while, he had eventually adjusted to doing home care with a woman on our block, took a few kids in.
Mm.
And he did that full-time for a year and a half. And then at a year and a half, we put him in part-time to a daycare program. And that seems very good, and he really likes it, and part-time staying with the home care person. So, I mean, we've been pretty good with, I think we've sort of, our child care, it's just always a struggle because you're not with a kid as much as you'd like.
Right.
I think that, I understand people who want to be a full-time mom. And give him a lot of credit, too, because I also see how hard it can be.
Mm-hmm.
He's full-time with other kids, and I think that that's really good.
Mm-hmm.
And with other caretakers, and I'm really jealous that he's not with me,
mm-hmm.
but he doesn't seem to suffer at all. I think he benefits from the exposure he gets
mm-hmm.
and the schedule that we maintain, the money that we have to pay for it and all that,
mm-hmm.
but we manage
mm-hmm.
it. So we both, are doing okay with working full-time with our income so we can swing it, and that's the trade-off.
Mm-hmm. So what would you tell him about going into the trades?
If he wants to,
yeah.
I just hope he, I think that he'll know what a carpenter does very early on.
Mm.
We visit Ellie on the, if Ellie has overtime on the weekend, we'll go over and visit her on the job.
Mm.
He'll come here and we'll play in one of the shops, shop classrooms here.
Mm.
Mm. He visits our jobs, I think that's nice,
mm-hmm.
and to get an idea. And if he wants to go into a trade, it's not bad money, and that's okay, and he can. I mean, I'm kind of like, I just want him to have an idea of what different people do so he can decide what he wants to do.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. So the tradeswomen movement. Were you ever part of, United Tradeswomen, or that
I went to meetings.
Yeah.
I went to UT meetings. They were towards the end of their existence when I came back to New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not really clear how it, died off, but I went to a few meetings, and then there weren't any more meetings to go to. And then a couple years ago, they had a 10-year anniversary, and I went to that, and it was fun. I wish there was something like it now, but things are really kind of divided in New York. And I was, that I was on staff at New, and I've been a tradeswoman. I mean, I sort of know about all these other things that are going on, but New York City doesn't have a real grassroots tradeswomen's movement, As a matter of fact, I was interviewed a few months ago, and someone asked me about the tradeswomen's movement, and I had
mm-hmm.
to say, what tradeswomen's movement? Although, I do get newsletters, and I am aware that, and I've gone to some conferences, and that there is a network out there. When I worked at New, I was aware that part of the network is based on nonprofit agencies that do what New does, doing the training programs for women coming into the trades.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is women who are in the trades talking and supporting each other.
Mm-hmm.
And New York, our network of women talking and supporting each other doesn't relate to the training component.
Mm-hmm.
And in some places, it's all one organization, and some places
mm-hmm.
it's divided. New York's divided, and part of the division with the grassroots of the support end of it, the tradeswomen talking, is I think a lot of issues of leadership.
Hmm.
Different people having to, given up leadership, other people
mm-hmm.
having taken it on, and the personalities
mm-hmm.
split,
mm-hmm.
UT, and they continue to actually split the general population of tradeswomen. We don't come together.
A few years ago, there was the regional council
uh-huh.
of tradeswomen, and now there seems to be sort of a push for a national tradeswomen network.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder, Well, do you have any ideas on how that would shape up, or?
I think it's hard. I mean, I've gone to regional council meetings, and I think that I went to regional council meetings a year ago or 2 years ago. They were really bad. They were really boring. They were really in-club stuff. Like, if you didn't know what they were talking about, you wouldn't know what they were talking about. Because nobody brought in anybody new, and it was a lot of government women, you know, female government bureaucrats who care about these issues, and a couple, and then a few tradeswomen themselves, and a couple other people who relate. But it just didn't feel like authentic networking. It felt, I felt very alienated, and I'm not easily alienated because I usually like walk in and have something to say about anything. So I just think that that's telling. I just think that if I feel alienated, someone who's sort of like can well adjust to any group and to any group, imagine how anyone who's shy or isn't real active might feel. So I was not impressed, and I went to a few meetings, and then it sort of, they stopped meeting. Recently I heard they want to start meeting again, and I said I would get involved if they want it, if they do it. But there's a lot, I mean, I think there's a lot of personalities going on that keep not real.
Yeah.
Welcoming. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
And have you gone to any of those meetings?
A couple of years ago I did.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But then it sort of fell apart.
Uh-huh.
And I was in school and I couldn't attend. And then now that I'm back in the game again, they're not happening. But I do sort of harbor this dream of the national, of a New York tradeswoman network, kind of like that you're talking about, that's so hard to happen here. It happens other places, like in Oregon and Boston. And,
right.
And I don't know why it's so difficult to happen here. Like, the closest thing is, for me at all, it's the Woman Carpenters Committee. But that's, like, not the other trades.
What about New York tradeswomen? Have you ever called them or doing
it? It's not happening for a couple of years.
They're all just on paper.
Yeah. I mean, they used to meet regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And now, for a couple of years now, they haven't. I think that the leadership in that group is now sort of focused on the Women Carpenters Committee and trying to make that a legitimate thing, you know.
I think it's all problematic.
Mm-hmm.
I do. I think that, I'm not sure why, I can't put my finger on it, and it'd be more of chatting stuff than interview stuff, I think, unless it's some part of the interview you really want.
Well, I mean, no, just, you know, no, yeah, I was just chatting.
Yeah, I just think there's some personalities who are not
real
good at bringing in other people and making it something that can work, that's open.
Yeah.
And it feels really, you know, the New York tradeswomen has felt closed. And
yeah, I know what you mean. What about Beijing? You got any thoughts on Beijing or?
No, are you going?
I would like to, but, you know, I don't know, I have to see how the finances go and everything, you know. I mean, I would like to go as part of the tradeswoman thing, but again, I feel like I wonder if it's going to really be a representative sample, or if it's just going to be the people that know each other and everything.
Hmm. Is there some networking happening towards Beijing?
Yeah, they want to send a tradeswoman group, and they want to have a tradeswoman workshop.
Oh. Great.
And, they mentioned Boston Tradeswomen Network was organizing someone, and they wanted to send 12 women from around the country. And, just how they're going to pick those 12 and who those 12 will be and all like that is what remains to be seen.
Wow.
But, yeah. So tomorrow's the start of Women's History Month. And is there any thing that you know about tradeswomen going on for that?
I know nothing.
And I just know of one firefighter thing at the Brooklyn Historical Society, some women firefighters, and again, I guess New York's a hard nut to crack, but I wish that, I feel like that we should be getting a lot of exposure. Every year during Women's History Month, I always feel like we should be getting a lot of exposure as tradeswomen. You know, to, I guess, be speaking in the schools and all like that.
It is hard. I mean, I've heard people speak again and again about wanting to speak in the schools. And it wasn't until I started working at New that I realized On the one hand, it's like if you're not employed full-time where you can, in a job where you can go out and speak in schools, you're not available.
Right.
You've got a lot of outreach to do and to for the schools to know about you, to contact you, to come and speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've just got to be readily available. Right. At New, we were able to do that. And here at the Carpenter School, we don't even ask. And we get calls all the time for career day speakers.
Mm.
And I've said to my supervisor, I think you should send the women, because
mm-hmm.
I think that's who needs to go to these things.
Mm-hmm.
Any one of us can tell them what a carpenter does,
mm-hmm.
but it's the women who can influence the women. And I think, and I hope that sort of from a sort of more, being in an official location, that I can have that same impact that we otherwise intend. You know, that as a women's organization, we say we want to get into the schools, but they don't call women's organizations. They call
right.
labor, they call
right.
the trades.
The carpenter school.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's kind of an interesting place to be because you see that from this official capacity you can have the same impact.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Yeah. I mean, I go out there a lot, especially this time of year, spring, they have all these career days.
Yeah,
it's
I used
part
to,
of the curriculum.
Yeah, I used to do it. I used to have carte blanche with my supervisor, but that supervisor's not there anymore. Now I have one that's not open to that anymore.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, back to the Contract on America or something.
Yes.
let's see. So, what...
The survival in terms of how am I going to tell other apprentices how to survive. And I think, you know, for me, one of my strategies was just keep on working. Not to, you know, when the union didn't have work for me, I kept on working. I mean, I remember the time a friend said she wanted a loft bed built, and I went to the library and I read about fasteners, and I went to the hardware store and I asked more questions than they could tolerate, and whatever I charged her, I must have made like $3 a day. I mean, it just took me so long. I ended up building her 2 loft beds for her and her friend, and I remember it was like, I don't want to say it was over my head. It was right at my level, but
mm-hmm.
it was a challenge. And so partly it's like, one of my strategies for survival was just to keep on working, to keep on taking on challenges, to keep on doing something, even if no one's going to give it to you. No one gave, you know, union never called me for work, and I kept on figuring out ways to work. Even though it might have been subsistence level of money coming in, and it was by continuously working, you're continuously learning.
Mm-hmm.
I kept on finding out ways to learn. And I remember being very, very demoralized when I got laid off of a job that they never had me do anything besides move materials.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really disappointed that they laid me off because I was the best damn materials handler around, and how could they lay me off? And it turned out to be a really good opportunity because I wasn't learning anything there.
Mm.
I was, you know. And so the other thing was that I learned was that, you know, when a door closes, you can have better opportunities. This
mm.
isn't it. So one of the strategies for survival is to just keep on working. Another one is my sense of humor really, really had to change. And I remember during my apprenticeship being appalled at the level of sexism when a woman's husband followed her, came. A woman carpenter apprentice, her husband came on the job and beat her up in the morning before work started. And by the time I arrived and everybody else, it was the rumor. It had already occurred. He had come and followed her and beat her. And I was appalled, and I was having conversations with everybody, and everybody was like, you don't get involved with that. That's his right. And, you know, touch that with a 10-foot pole. And, you know, it was all about non-involvement and condoning it because you don't know what the business was. He could be right in doing it. And I was appalled for days. Now I think I would have, even though it's still an appalling thing, I don't want to say nothing about my sense of humor in this instance, but more in terms of how I tolerated the crew.
Mm.
It wasn't that, I don't think I should ever change my ability to not tolerate that incident, but how I handled everybody's response. I took everybody so seriously, and I ended up so angry at everybody, because everyone, all the guys I worked with, no matter whether it was somebody I thought I liked or not, everybody sort of had the same response to this. Sort of like since then, the Mike Tyson thing came up.
Mm.
It's like if I stayed dogmatic in my responses, you can't survive.
Right.
You have to walk out. And I have walked out in different instances, and I've changed jobs, or I went to my union, or I, you know, went to Nicaragua, or whatever. I mean, I have had instances, and I have walked into the bathroom and cried, and I have, you know, had horrible days when I came home, but my own sense of tolerance of these people and their opinions has had to adjust. Again, not to say that I now tolerate these opinions, but I've figured out ways to maneuver within them, different ways to have conversations, or to avoid conversations, or to change to things about humor, or to turn things around.
What predictors of success would you tell women coming in to that they would? Qualities. Would that be the same as strategies for survival?
Their own predictors? What would be a predictor for themselves?
Yeah.
It might be similar to strategies for survival, but it's an interesting different question. I mean, predictors of success often are how long you can keep a job, although you don't want to get too involved in that. The fact is we work ourselves out of a job every day we go to work, and the fact is that there's tremendous bias against women no matter how good you are. So I don't want to make that too much of the you know, barometer, because that would be a setup. But how well how confident you feel handling your own tools, when your tools start to feel like your own. I think pride in your toolbox and ownership of your tools is something that you can really like gauge when that starts to happen and they feel like yours. And you know, I mean, I still have my toolbox, although the tools kind of are spread out around the house now, but I have my toolbox and I see my certain things that I just have a certain warm feeling for. I think that when you start acquiring that, you become a tradeswoman and not an apprentice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you think of any other critical issues for tradeswomen activists?
Well, I think unionism are important issues. Labor issues are important issues. In terms of sort of looking at, especially the contract on America and everything else that goes on in terms of what kind of rights might we have as workers, I think those are important issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think training issues. How do people get trained and how do people come in? Affirmative action issues, although affirmative action might, as a term, might phase out as a concept. I think we need to figure out ways that the concept of equity and opportunities for training and opportunities for entry into the trade need to be maintained. Maintained is a poor choice of words because they haven't even existed all that much. Maintained, strengthened, and developed. That we need to be, I think, involved in those issues, and the issues of equity and training. Of course, issues of sexism and racism and how that affects all of those things.
I wanted to ask you about your sexual harassment course. They asked you to teach that?
The evolvement of that, how that came to be, is that there was somebody worked as a consultant here at the Carpenter School, Mary Ellen Boyd. She has a long history. She was the executive director of New many years ago. And about 4 years ago, she worked on a grant here with the Carpenters on, I think they called it instructor development. It was a special projects grant, and it involved a few things. It involved some special training for the instructors, and it involved some money to give sexual harassment training to the apprentices and to the instructors, and to develop some instructors who could give that training. And they did that grant with New. The grant was they would give so much money to New to pay them to train here at the school, for staff from New to give a training at the school and to train some of their instructors, and for the Carpenters to develop a pamphlet on sexual harassment. So Mary Ellen Boyd worked very hard on it with somebody else who knew. I was on staff at New at the time, but I wasn't involved. At the beginning, I wasn't involved in this project at all. Sort of my, to my dismay, but that's, I wasn't involved. And I wasn't pulled in, and I wasn't informed, and I was unrelated to it, except sort of for, to see it as it developed. As things went on, Mary Ellen left as her consultant position, but the grant was in full swing. And the person from New, who was giving the training, became very ill and subsequently passed away. And I was on staff at New, and I was on part-time staff here at the school, and I was asked to fill in and teach that course as a staff member from New. And I did that. And partly in the interim, I think, my doing that and doing a few other things representing New with the Carpenters are the things that got me to be asked to come on full-time to school. So when I was asked to come on full-time with the school, it was, and you can continue doing this training. And I didn't want to take this training away from New, so I looked into the history of it and found out that the grant was actually for a year. The year had expired. They actually hadn't trained anybody on staff at the Carpenter School like they had originally agreed. But here I am. I'm on staff at the Carpenter School, and I was trained.
Right.
So I now give it. Yeah.
That's like, great. I love the pamphlet.
Oh, good. I give it, and I've tried to train a few people on staff here, and that's really hard, because I want men to be able to give the class, but I have yet to have found, I haven't yet, you know, developed that well, so you'll see if you sit in on any of the classes.
Yeah, I'd love to sometime.
I can give you a schedule. I'm bringing some men in, but what happens is you give up control when it's not same workshop when other people are co-teaching it.
Yeah.
And I, it's a little tough, a little tricky.
That's great, though. It's great that they're doing that.
Well, hopefully they'll train for shop stewards and foremen and supers next.
Yeah, I know.
They slash we.
No, I did that. They did that on my job, but now they need a refresher course. You know.
Yeah. Who gave the training?
It was in-house. It was films and. Or maybe they did hire.
Board of Ed?
Yeah, maybe they did hire consultants. You know, I can't remember. It was so, I was so sensitive about it all because I felt like nobody was taking it seriously. I mean, the people giving it were, but I mean, the, my coworkers. Well, that's about it. Anything else you can think of that you'd like to add?
No, you could just tell me more about the study.
That what we're doing with it? Well, it's